I offer my sincere gratitude to each and every one of you for so kindly participating in this evening's Chaitanya Festival. The subject is Are you sure? The subject of tonight's lecture is Live and Learn, something like that. That is the purpose of life. In this world, the real value of life is what we learn and the substance of our character, our realization, and our closeness to God. After all, there are trees that live for thousands of years. In the Calcutta Botanical Garden, there's a tree that is said to be 5,000 years old. And in California, there are redwood trees. Some are said to be 7,000 years old. We cannot even fathom the history that those trees have lived through in this world. There are trees that actually have been sitting there, just watching and absorbing, practically as long as man has, Western man has, calculated modern history. But what is the greatness of such a tree? There are tortoises that live over 100 years old. There are parrots that live hundreds of years old. The special facility of human life is in its quality. Because the human life provides the opportunity to question our existence. There is no other species that has that power. We can ask, who am I? What is the purpose of life? Where am I coming from? Where am I going? Who is God? What is my relationship with God? Why is there suffering? And is there something beyond? All the lower species, be they plants, trees, fish, insects, reptiles, birds, beasts, they are simply trying to enjoy their momentary senses and also trying to create some arrangement for their sustenance for the future. Nayam deho dehavajam loke kastan kaman arhati vidbujam jay. Eating, sleeping, mating, defending, creating a situation for oneself, for one's family, some security. That is what every species of life is doing. What is special about human existence? It is the junction where we can actually enter into the realm of spirituality, where we could realize who we really are. Therefore, for a human being passing through this material world, the great benediction is what we learn from our experiences, from what comes upon us, from what comes upon our loved ones, from what we see throughout history of mankind, and what is happening on the earth. You see, we have freedom because our reality is our perception. There is a truth. There is an absolute truth. But for every living being, our particular reality is our particular perception of that truth and the phenomena around us. Just like it is said, one person's food is another person's poison. It is the same thing. Some people see the deities of Radha Gopinath and they cry in happiness that my Lord is awakening such love in my heart. How kind. And somebody else sees and runs away thinking, idol worship. One person sees a beautiful flower and thinks, let me smell it. Or let me extract the essence of it and sell it for money. Yes? And somebody else is saying, let me put it in the hair of my bride. And someone else is seeing it and thinking, I have hay fever. This is going to cause me great suffering. And someone else sees that same flower and thinks, let me offer it to Krishna with devotion. So the same object, there's no two people in the entire creation that sees one object the same way. Because according to our mind and the conditioning of the senses, we are perceiving the phenomena through the filter of that state of consciousness. Is that understandable? Our particular state of mind is filtering everything and bringing it to a particular perception. Just like Prabhupada said, if you're wearing yellow-colored glasses, you see everything yellow. If you have red-colored glasses, you see everything red. If you have green-colored glasses, everything is green. And if you have clear glasses, then you see everything as it is. So really, what is reality? Every situation of life, we have a choice. We could learn and grow in that situation, or there are innumerable other alternatives. Yes? Somebody insults you. You can cry and be depressed. That's one choice. You can seek vengeance to destroy that person in various ways. By destroying their reputation, by plundering their wealth. Some people kill. Or you can just go in a closet and cry and feel sorry for yourself and go to a psychiatrist and say that I've been mistreated, I've been misunderstood. Or you could also, in that situation, try to see, what is God trying to teach me? How through this situation am I to improve the quality of my character and my relationship with the Lord? How through this situation I could be a better person? If you're searching for that learning experience, that is what you will find. In the Bible it is said, seek and ye shall find. Krishna tells in Gita, as you approach me, I reveal myself accordingly. If we're looking for the hand of God in every situation, we'll find that. Some of you know my very, very dear friend and God brother. His name is His Holiness Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj. Can I say something about him? He's African American. He was brought up in the ghettos of Cleveland, Ohio, if you know where that is. But he was a very good student, very hard worker. And all of his life, he was always, because he was an underdog, he was persecuted for his race. He was discriminated against. He didn't seek vengeance. It made him a very, very compassionate living being. He became very, very understanding, sympathetic, and wanting to help everyone in whatever situation they happened to be in. Because he knew what it was like to suffer. He knew what it was like to be discriminated against and to be hated. So instead of becoming angry, instead of taking shelter of intoxications, he wanted to try to do something wonderful to correct the bad in humanity, to uplift the underdog and educate those who were in illusion. And he went to Princeton University. And there at Princeton University, he was the leader of civil rights movement, which was equal rights for minorities. He was also working for the United Nations in various ways of trying to uplift human society, dealing with people's depression. But he really wanted to do something wonderful, because life doesn't last very long. When you're young, we tend to be in the illusion that life will just go on forever. But when you start getting older, you realize that 40, 50, 60 years, it passed in what seems like a moment. We see old people, crippled, sickly, dying. In their hearts, just a few moments ago, they were your age. Young, healthy, happy, sometimes. So life passes fast. So he was an intelligent young man. With my life, I have to do whatever is the best thing I could possibly do. So he sought spiritual solutions. Because spiritual solutions are permanent. And he saw that the greatest saints, rishis, and enlightened people who did the greatest for humanity throughout history were people who had deep, deep faith and dedication to God. That is the one thing common in all the great religions of the world. Anyone who follows any true religion with real sincerity, they develop purity of heart. And what is the fruit of that purity of heart? Compassion for others, self-control, morality, good character, and most of all, love. Love for God and love for every living being as our brothers and sisters, as children of God. And willingness to make sacrifices for the spiritual upliftment of others. And wherever we find these qualities, That is real spirituality. Bhagavad Gita describes Vidyavanaya Sampani Brahmani Gavihastini Suni Chaiva Swapakicha Pandita Samadarshana. But what is the nature of a person who is actually spiritually learned? And this is a universal principle, it is not sectarian. The person sees that every living being is part of God. Every living being is a spirit soul, eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. If you love God, you must love every part of Him, regardless of whatever the temporary condition that that spirit soul may be in. Whether a person is a learned Brahman, or whether the person is living in a very downtrodden situation, even a sinful person, a criminal person, an elephant, a dog, and it doesn't matter. The soul within the heart that is giving life is pure. We cannot but love the soul. Although that soul is entrapped due to its particular karmic past in a particular situation, with a particular mentality, in a particular species of life. That is knowledge. So to have that consciousness is the greatest thing that we can do with our life. So he wanted that. So he was searching for spiritual guidance. And in 1971, he met His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. And the inclusiveness, the essential spiritual depth of what he was teaching attracted his heart so much that he gave his life to assisting. And since that time, Bhakti Tirtha Swami, I have seen, he's been in the jungles of Africa, dangerous places where most people never go, and they love him there. He's elevating people's consciousness. And the next day, he's with the most famous celebrities on earth, in Hollywood, in Manhattan Island, speaking to them. Muhammad Ali used to take guidance from him. Big, big celebrities, very much seeking hope and guidance. Heads of states, presidents of nations, simple widows, abused children, without discrimination. He's simply trying to give God's love to everyone and anyone. And this is how he spent the last 35 years of his life. Just last August, very suddenly, without any expectation, he was diagnosed with cancer and given 6 months to live. Shocking. Now, in such a situation, we have many choices of how to perceive this. We can think, why is God doing this to me? I've given my life to Him. He became a sannyasi. He gave up the pleasures and the enjoyments of a family, a home, his own income. He just lived totally as a mendicant servant of human society. So many hardships he endured for the welfare of others. He could have thought, why is God doing this to me? After all I've done for Him, why is He doing this for me? He could have become depressed. He could have become angry. He could have lost his faith. Bhakti Tirtha Swami has just written a book. He has a series of books called The Beggar. This is The Beggar 3. And he started writing it the day he received the news that he was going to die in 6 months. It's called Die Before Dying. And he asked me to write the foreword for the book. So the book hasn't come out, but I've read it. Because he sent me an advanced manuscript for the purpose of writing foreword. And you will be so amazed to see this person's consciousness. He's absolutely full of gratitude, humility, and joy by the news. Now, whatever the news is what it is. Your attitude doesn't change the news, but it changes how that news is going to affect you. He's thanking God. In this book, he's praying to the cancer cells. He's saying, "My dear cancer cells, you're trying to survive, and I'm trying to survive." Because he went through all kinds of different naturopathic, allopathic treatments to try to overcome it. Because Srimad Bhagavatam explains that God gives you a body, and it's your duty to try to sustain and maintain your body for the highest purpose. If God gives you a body, God's body should not be neglected. It's an instrument. It's a vehicle. If you have a car, just because you're not your car, it doesn't mean you neglect it. It has a purpose to serve. So it's our duty to try to fight against disease and death, but without attachment. That is the secret. So he went through all these different treatments and so forth, and it just wasn't working. So he's praying that cancer cells, you know, you're also living beings, and you're trying to survive, and I'm trying to survive, and somehow you're winning the fight. I forgive you. I forgive you and wish you all well, and pray to Krishna for your benefits also. This is his spirit. And he's looking at all of his friends and all of his God brothers and God sisters and all of his disciples and all people on earth and just feeling such immense gratitude and just wanting to give every ounce of whatever life he has left to just offer that as a joyful celebration to Krishna and humanity. He's actually in a spirit of joyfully, humbly, gratefully, forgivingly celebrating. That is perception. Because he knows that the soul is eternal. He knows that this body has to go sometime or other, either today or tomorrow or the next day. But that this news had made him so serious. He's taking shelter of God's message, taking shelter of God's name, taking shelter of God's devotees more than he ever has before, and he's thanking God for this chance. So yes, we will be affected by our environment according to our conscious perception. not according to the particular circumstances that we're in. Another dear friend of ours, Sridhar Swami Maharaj, he was also in a similar situation. And I remember he would often say, to be in pain is inevitable, but to suffer is optional. It just depends on our perception. So if we always want to be illuminated, enlightened, and enriched, we must learn how to perceive things in a positive attitude and learn something substantially good from that experience. Live and learn. Thomas Edison. You've all heard of him? Why have you heard of him? Because he lived and learned on a certain level. He was a scientist. He experimented to make a battery and failed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. And every time he failed, he just kept going. And he was enthusiastic. So after over 1,000 failures, one journalist said to him, "Don't you ever become discouraged?" Because he still hadn't made the battery work yet. And he said, "No, I'm not discouraged." He said, "They're not failures. Every time it doesn't work, I learn one more way it's not going to work. And that brings me one step closer to finding how it will work." Hare Krishna. It's perception. And because he had that enthusiasm, he was always learning in a positive attitude, that's why you have all heard about him. His greatness didn't come just from some karma of a previous life. That was there. But you have to do something with your karma too. It was his determination. It was his enthusiasm. It was his positive attitude. To learn from every experience in life. History. There's so much to learn from history. There's so much to learn from our own mistakes. It is said that a successful person is not a person who does not make mistakes. A successful person is a person who does make mistakes, but who learns from them and doesn't repeat them. And an unsuccessful person, they make mistakes and they just don't learn anything. But actually, you don't have to make mistakes. You could also learn from the mistakes of others. And learn from our own successes, and learn from the successes of others. Every moment is a chance to learn something. In this connection, I would like to speak something from Srimad Bhagavatam, with your permission. There was a great king named Yadu. And he was traveling through many different countries. And at one time, he was going through a forest. And he happened to see an avadut. Avadut means a person who apparently is a totally social outcast. He was just laying in the forest. Something like a python, just laying there. And whatever comes, comes. Whatever doesn't come, it doesn't matter. Yes? So from material, social considerations, he was really not at all a successful person. But Yadu was a religious man. He saw him. He was so bright-faced. In fact, he never saw anyone look so happy in his whole life. So he asked this avadut, "How is it that you're living in such a poverty state and you're so happy? Who is your guru? Where did you learn this?" And the answer is several chapters of Srimad Bhagavatam. This particular section of Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is personally instructing Uddhav in the science of self-realization. And he's quoting this avadut. He replied, "My dear king, I am completely satisfied with whatever I have, with whatever I am, and with whatever's happening around me. And I will tell you why. Because wherever I look, I see God teaching me." He said, "When you look at the things of this world in terms of your own selfish enjoyment, that's all you see. You see a car, you see a house, you see clothing, you see a tree, and you're thinking, how can I enjoy this? And that's all you see." But he said, "Because I have no desire for personal selfish ego, I'm always hearing a message of God. And I will tell you what I have learned from 24 gurus who have instructed me." There are different types of guru. One guru is the guru who actually introduces you to the spiritual path. Another type of guru is Diksha Guru, one who gives you initiation into mantra. And another guru is Shiksha Guru. There could be many Shiksha Gurus. They are those whose words and whose example is inspiring and enlightening our lives. So he said, "I have many instructing gurus, and I'd like to tell you what I have learned from some of them. Would you like to hear?" "Thank you." He said, "One of my gurus is the earth. I have learned from the earth the spirit of selfless service. Mother Earth, even though she's harassed and plundered by so many people, she continues to serve. They're drilling oil in the earth. They're polluting the earth. They're soaking the earth with the blood of innocent animals, with the blood of military soldiers in the battlefields. Greedy people are cutting the lush forests of the earth and making them into wastelands just to make some money for wood or to grow some crop. Tobacco, grains for alcohol, and things like this. Although untold abuse and harassment of our Mother Earth, she continues always to provide all necessities for all living beings. Selfless service. This I learn every time he sees the earth. He's seeing the example of total selfless servant. The willingness to endure all disturbances, all unjust attacks. And even for those who are harassing her, She's providing all necessities for their lives. Never diverted from the path of service. And this principle of selfless servant, he said, I also learned from the mountain. The mountain carries the burden of huge quantities of earth. Yes? But with everything, the mountain is simply giving for the happiness of others. The trees, the insects, the humans, the animals, providing water, providing vegetation. Selfless service. And he also learned that same principle from the tree. Vinarapi sunichena taror ivasihishnana. How many times do you see the earth? Do you ever learn something? How many times do you see trees? Every time he sees a tree, he's enlightened, he's illuminated. Just examine the tolerance and the charity of a tree. The tree is standing in the burning sun to give us shade. This tree is standing in freezing ice cold to give us wood to be warm. The tree is giving flowers and fruits and never complains. Even if you cut the tree, even if you cut the very body of the tree will give its wood to build you a house. He learned tolerance, patience, in a spirit of service for the welfare of others, from the tree and from the sun. We all see the sun every day. When Avadhut sees the sun, he learns the same spirit of selfless service. The sun evaporates water, and what does it do with the water? It creates rain and gives the water back to the earth. Yes? Seawater is useless for many of our purposes. The sun will evaporate the seawater and make it into pure rainwater. Now, here in Bombay, we live near the sea. But what happens if there's no good monsoon? There's unlimited quantities of water just two blocks away at Chopati Beach. But yet, every day, the Bombay Water Department only turns on water for a couple hours a day, and everybody's turning on their tanks and filling up. Yes? Very much. And some years there's not enough monsoon rain and there's very, very big cry of concern. How will we survive? How will we wash? How will we drink? How will we cook? That is the benediction of the sun. Just taking the water and making it into something wonderful and giving it back to society. Similarly, a saintly person, whatever they learn, whatever they take from this world, they use it for the welfare of others. We learn knowledge. But there's a saying that one who has knowledge but does not enlighten others with that knowledge, it's like a lamp under a pot. What is its use? The purpose of knowledge is to be enlightened and to enlighten others. So whatever knowledge a saintly person gets, whatever skills a person achieves, whatever talents, whatever wealth, whatever we take like the sun, we want to use to give back for the welfare of others. And another special feature of the sun, he learned, is just like God in his name. The name of God descends into the darkness of the world to give light. And that is the purpose of knowledge. Om Agyan Timirandasya. To reflect the sun of Krishna's grace and give light in this world is the most fulfilling experience a human being can attain. This is what he had learned from the sun. And then he explained what he learned from fire. Several different wonderful observations. One is that fire, it's always a flame looks like it's a steady flame. But actually, it's constantly appearing and disappearing, appearing and disappearing. Yes? Fire is not constant. A flame only lasts a second. It's gone. It just keeps regenerating, as long as there's fuel. But it looks constant. So similarly, the spirit soul, which is constant, it looks at this phenomenal world, our bodies, and the world around us, and everything looks like it has some constancy. But factually, the powerful waves of the river of time is creating change at every moment. Imperceptibly, you're all getting old. You may not see it, but it's happening, just like the flames of fire. The whole world. Everything's temporary. Nothing will last. But we're seeing it that way. He learned that from the fire. How whatever looks like it has permanence is actually very transient. The only thing that is permanent is the eternality of the soul. And he also learned a very valuable saintly quality from fire. Even the most contaminated things, if you put in fire, it is consumed. It doesn't disturb the fire. Yes? Some people cook with cow dung. That is considered very pure. Yes? So fire will consume the cow dung. But even if you throw your own dung, which is not considered pure, maybe you think so, but nobody else will, the fire will consume it. Whatever you put. That is the nature of humility. Whatever comes to a saintly person, because a saintly person, his or her heart is within the fire of devotion. He never deviated from the path. If you give praise to a saintly person, like fire, it will not disturb, it will not create false ego. Because a saintly person understands that everything's the property of God. Nothing is mine. So whatever praise comes belongs to him. And even if you give gifts to a saintly person will not become egoistic or attached. A saintly person will understand it's the property of the Lord and use it for the purpose of the Lord, for the purpose of others. In this way, humility is like fire. We never become implicated, complicated, or put in a condition of bondage as long as that fire of humility is within our heart. and he explained what he learned from water. When water is pure, it's transparent. And it sounds very sweet when it flows. Similarly, a saintly person is a person who speaks and behaves in such a way that is very, very pleasing to the hearts of others. And also, just as water purifies, the saintly person acts and words purify us. In association with water, we become cleansed. In association with a saint, sadhu sanga, sarvalatra, sarva sarstrakoi, lavamatra sadhu sanga, sarva siddhivoi. We become purified in the association of saintly persons. Why? Because they transparently reveal the love of God that is within their hearts. And then he taught a lesson of detachment that he learned from the wind and the sky. Should I continue? The wind will blow sometimes over a field of roses and carries sweet fragrance. Sometimes the wind will flow over a waterfall and carry very refreshing mist of cooling, soothing waters. Sometimes the wind will flow through a sewage pit and carry the disgusting stench of human excrements. But the wind remains the same. The wind is unaffected in whatever environment it may be in. The wind always remains neutral. Similarly, a person whose mind is fixed in God consciousness or Krishna consciousness, even having passed through so many different auspicious and inauspicious situations in life, always remains fixed in purpose. It's like our Guru Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada. He was living in Vrindavan, in the holiest part of Vrindavan, the place of Krishna and Radha's Raslila. Beautiful forest of desire trees. For the sake of uplifting humanity, due to the compassion of his heart, he left Vrindavan. And he came to Bombay with all pollutions and so much greed and so much competition for ego. And then he went on Jaladuta, a cargo ship on the Atlantic Ocean over the Arabian Sea first. He had several heart attacks, seasickness. Then he came to New York City, and he didn't know anyone, and he had no funds, no money. So he was living in a ghetto, the Bowery, in an area with prostitutes, drunkards, drug addicts, criminals. But he was the same. He was a kind, well-wishing gentleman in all situations. Whether he was in Vrindavan or New York City in Bowery, he was simply trying to give God's love to others. He was unaffected. And later on, when his movement began to grow, people were offering him huge, beautiful mansions. George Harrison of the Beatles bought a beautiful, beautiful mansion in Lechmore Heath, a suburb of London. And he named it Bhaktivedanta Manor. And they gave Prabhupada the best room in that. And later on in the same Manhattan, in Midtown, there was a skyscraper on 55th Street, and they gave him a whole floor. For Prabhupada, it didn't matter whether he was living in a little bhajan kutir in Vrindavan, whether he was on the boat, cargo ship, Jaladuta, having heart attacks, whether he was living in the Bowery, practically homeless, or whether he was living in mansions. Because whatever is auspicious or inauspicious, a saintly person is unaffected by that. There's a beautiful verse. Tasmad sankirtanam Vishno jagan mangalamang hasa mahato api kauravya vidyaikantakar niskritam. That when one chants the name of the Lord, when one has faith in the name of the Lord, then every situation becomes completely auspicious by that consciousness. So just like the wind, it can be in a dirty place or in a beautiful place, but it passes through that situation of life with integrity. That is a good person. Because as we pass through life, there are so many experiences that we do not expect, that we do not plan. Crisis, disasters, failures, successes, honor, dishonor, pleasure, pain, happiness, distress, health, disease, birth, death. This is a world of dualities. You cannot avoid dualities. But how we respond. A great soul is like the wind. They'll pass through all circumstances of life. There's a beautiful mantra we chant. Om apavitra apavitro va sarvavastam gatopi va yasmarek pundarikaksam sabaya abhyantara suchi. Whether we're purified or unpurified, or even having passed through every type of situation in life, one who just remembers the beautiful lotus-eyed Supreme Personality of Godhead is purified within and without. And he learned the same principle from the sky. The sky, everything is within it, but the sky remains neutral. Yes? Sometimes it's a nice sunny day. Sometimes there's clouds in the sky. Sometimes there's cyclones blowing from the sky. But whatever's coming and going, the sky remains neutral. So similarly, we are eternal souls. The more we realize our soul, the more we realize our eternal, unchanging nature, the more we live by our nature of service to God and service to all others, then whatever passes through our life, we can remain stable and the same. Our determination, whether cyclones come or sunny days, we know that they're all transient, they're all temporary, and we take shelter always of what is permanent. Should I continue? He learned from the moon. The moon is always waxing and waning. There is Purnima, full moon, and there's also Amavasya, no moon. Now, from our perception, there's a big difference between Purnima and Amavasya. One is illuminating the sky and one is dark. The more you live in a natural situation, the more you're sensitive to all these things. I remember in the 1970s, I was living on a mountain. And every night at 9 o'clock, I had to walk down this mountain. There was no road. It was just mud. It was mud in the summer and ice in the winter. And I had to walk 3 kilometers down. And then at 2:30 in the morning, I had to walk 3 kilometers up. And I never saw that road in the light of day. And it was a really secluded forest. When there was a full moon, I could practically dance down that mountain. But I remember sometimes when it was a no moon, Amavasya, it was so dark, and I never had a torch or flashlight, because those things were considered opulences. I remember just walking right into a tree. One time I walked off the road and rolled down the mountain. It took me about 3 minutes of rolling until I bounced off a few trees and then landed in a creek of water. And it was so dark I couldn't find my way up. Arrivo. So on the moonlit night, everything is very, very illuminated. But on dark night, very dark. That's our perception. Actually, the moon is completely detached. The moon is the same. The moon doesn't change. It's the reflection of the sun. It affects us. It affects the whole world. But the waxing and waning of the moon does not affect the moon. Does that make sense? So what do we learn from this? There are 6 transformations of life. We are born, we grow, we sustain for some time, we may produce some offspring, and gradually the body will dwindle and ultimately die. Sure as death. But the soul is eternal. And the soul, the Atma, is the real you. The Atma is completely unaffected by all these transformations. Dehino smenyata dehe komarom yovaram chara. The soul passes from youth, from childhood to youth to old age, and ultimately death, and then a new body. Vasam sijanani yatavihaya. Bhagavad Gita says, what is death for the soul? It's just changing clothes. We change clothes every day. Most of us. And it's no big thing. Actually, for the soul, death is no big thing. It's just a change. Like the waxing and waning of the moon, it doesn't affect the soul. But when the soul is forgetful of its eternal identity and identifies with this waxing and waning phenomena of the body, then there's so many anxieties. So this is what Avadhut learned from the moon. Now I will tell you what he learned from the ocean. That the ocean, during the rainy season, large, large volumes of water is flowing into the ocean. And during the summer season, sometimes all those rivers dry up and nothing flows into the ocean. Yes? But is the ocean bigger in the rainy season and smaller in the summer season? Not at all. Apurgimanama chalapratishtam. Gita describes the same principle, that a saintly person is like the ocean. There are so many desires, so many sensual experiences that are flowing into a person's mind through the senses. But because of the ocean's depth, because of the ocean's
volume, it is simply unaffected by all these transformations. Similarly, when a person has deep knowledge, deep realizations, when a person is experiencing the joy of spiritual love, then all the dualities, the pleasures, the pains, the honors, the dishonors, the successive failures, they may come, and we understand them, and we deal with them, but we're not affected by them because of the depth of the substance of our internal experience. That is the purpose of life. That internal experience is there within every heart. The soul is Satchit Ananda. It is eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. But why we're not blissful? Because we're looking everywhere else except where it really is. Gita says, one who is illuminated within, who rejoices within, that is a person of real intelligence. And in the Bible, Lord Jesus says the same thing. Make your treasure not in this world, but in the kingdom of God. And the kingdom of God is within you. So, this is the quality of the ocean. So deep, so wide, nothing can affect it. And that same oceanic experience of happiness and love is within us. And when we just connect to it, that's the meaning of religio, religion, to connect with that. That is the meaning of yoga, to reunite with that experience. Then our happiness becomes like an ocean. He also learned the dangers of the illusory energy. He describes what he learned from his guru, the moth. Yes? That the moth is mad to enjoy fire. Have you seen? If you have a candle inside a window in the darkness of night, the moth will be poom, poom, just flying with all of its strength trying to break through the window to get to that fire. Because the eyes, the sense of sight, that sense is so powerful. And ultimately, after great effort, when the moth reaches its destination, enters fire, it is burned to ashes. Indriyanam hicharatam yanmano navatiyate tadasya harati pragya vayur navami vambasi. This is the nature of the senses. Any one of the senses, if they are not properly directed, can ruin a person's life. The moth is destroyed due to its addiction to the sense of sight. And the bee is very much attached to smelling fragrant things. So sometimes the bee goes into a flower and smells and smells and just doesn't want to leave. It smells and smells and smells, and then the sun sets and the flower closes. And the bee is imprisoned, trapped, sometimes dies due to being victimized by the sense of smell. And when, in the olden days, before they had guns that put elephants to sleep, the way they would catch elephants was not easy. How do you catch an elephant? There's a process. Elephants are very attached to touching. So if you want to catch a female elephant, you just put a male elephant. If you want to catch a male elephant, you put a female elephant. And you dig a big ditch and cover it with straw.
and the male elephant rubs, and then the female elephant is trained to go and pushes him in the well. So by the sense of touch, the elephant is captured. And the deer is very attracted to hear sweet sounds. That's why they have such big, beautiful ears. They love to hear sweet music. So when a hunter wants to catch the deer, he plays a flute. And the deer hears the flute and comes to that place and then is trapped in the net. And the fish, what is the weakness of a fish? Very strong desire to taste. So the fisherman knows that, and he puts the bait, some very nice food that the fish is attracted to, on a hook. Now, how many of you have fished in your life? Very honest man. I have learned through hearing how fishermen operate, and I will share this knowledge with you. If a fisherman wants to catch a fish, he puts the best possible food that the fish likes on a hook. And the fish doesn't see the hook, just sees the food. And he starts swimming toward it. And there may be some other fish that says, Prabhu or Mataji, don't eat that, there's a hook in it. He says, what nonsense you're speaking. It tastes good. And he eats it. But the fisherman knows, if he starts reeling it in now, it's going to just pop out of its mouth. So the fisherman just lets it eat and eat. And eat and chew it and chew it and chew it and swallow it and swallow it and swallow it until the hook is deep down inside of its stomach, and then pulls it out, and there's nothing the fish could do. Destroyed by its own attraction to the taste. So we understand that we have these five senses, and all the five senses are looking for pleasure. But what the Avadhut Brahman learned is we have to learn to use our senses in such a way that they elevate us and purify us and not degrade us. Sarvapadiva nirmuktam tatparatvena nirmalam rishikena rishikesa sevanam bhaktaruchyate. The same mind and senses can either elevate us or degrade us. It just depends on the type of pleasure we're looking for. You could look at the beautiful form of the deity. You could see the beautiful nature of God and remember God. And you could be elevated, purified by that experience and enjoy. Or you could use your sense of sight to look at obscene things that simply contaminate us and pollute us. We can eat nice prasad and be elevated and purified, or we can eat forbidden foods that have very, very serious karmic consequences and be degraded by that. You enjoy. I'm sure you're all waiting for me to end so you can enjoy prasad. Prasad purifies. It tastes beautiful and it purifies our heart. Why do we need to eat foods that karmically incriminate us with violence? Similarly, we could listen to cinema songs. What are they called? Ghazals or something like that? Huh? Ghazals. What do they sing about? Huh? They sing about drunken consciousness? Anyways, whatever they sing about, It doesn't elevate your consciousness. It aggravates your material desires to enjoy egoistic, selfish things. Yes? Or you can hear bhajan and kirtan and katha and enjoy. But that enjoyment purifies and elevates us and gives us a higher experience. Or we could hear gossip. Gossip is very popular. It's very difficult to overcome unless you have something higher. People, they make grand arrangements to fly thousands of miles to some meeting place just to gossip. It's to talk about this person did this and this person involved in this scandal and this person has done like that and this person is crazy and this person's a cheater. Yes? So much gossip. And what does gossip do? It just wastes our time. What do we benefit? But people enjoy it. It tastes like nectar. Why not gossip about Krishna? Hear and chant the glories of Krishna. Speak nice philosophy. Elevate people's consciousness. The same greater, deeper pleasure with the same sense. And fragrance. We can smell the incense of the Lord. It's offered to the Lord. The roses that are offered to the Lord. And purify our existence. Ambarish Maharaj perfected his life with the sense of touch by just cleaning the temple floor, touching the devotees, and using one's sense of touch in God's service. So Krishna consciousness does not deny the senses. That is very difficult. Does not deny the mind. We don't want to obliterate or void the mind and senses. We want to purify them by using them for the highest, sweetest, most enlightening purposes. And I will end with one more guru of the Avadhut, with your permission. He explained what he learned from the honeybee. The honeybee takes the nectar from every flower. And it's not concerned with everything else. Similarly, a saintly person is always eager to see the good qualities in other people. Always looking for the good. Always looking for the spiritual potential. There's also the fly. What did Avadhut learn from the fly and the honeybee? If you have a beautiful garden of fragrant flowers, yes, and one rat enters that garden and passes excrement, yes, what will give joy to the fly? The fly will think nothing of all the thousands of fragrant flowers and will go right to the stool and enjoy sucking it. And forgive me if I'm graphic, but that's the way flies are. We should understand this subject very carefully. But the honeybee, even if he's in an entire sewage area, if there's one flower within miles and miles of just horrible, disgusting sewage, the honeybee will only see that flower and take the nectar from the flower. So a person who has a very materialistic mentality is eager to find faults in others, like a fly. And a person who has proper spiritual consciousness is always looking for good qualities, is always looking for the essence. Amongst devotees, anyone who's even taking a step forward on the spiritual path is very rare. Dullabha manava janma. Manusyanam sahasreshu kashchid yatati siddhaye. Out of thousands and thousands and thousands of persons, one even attempts to even make a first step on this spiritual path. Prabhupada said to find faults with them is like pointing at the pod marks on the moon. The full moon is giving volumes and volumes and volumes of beautiful light. Instead of appreciating and offering gratitude, we'd say, look at that spot. So if we want to elevate our consciousness, we must follow the honeybee and not the fly. Swans will go where there's beautiful lotuses, and crows will go where there's garbage. It's interesting how there's more crows than swans in the city of Bombay. On the bird platform. On the human platform, there may be some connection also. Swans are looking for nectar, and crows are looking for just some gross sensual experience, garbage. There's something else we could learn from the honeybee. And this is very, very important, especially in this day and age that we are living. The honeybee always searches for the essence of nectar. A sincere, saintly person is looking for the essence of the scriptures, for the essence of religion, for the essence of the spiritual path. And what is that essence? The essence is the way to purify the heart to love God and to love all living beings. That is the essence. Bible says, the Old Testament as well as the New Testament, the first and great commandment is to love God with all your heart, all your mind, and all your soul. And Krishna tells in Gita, sarva dharman parityajya mam ekam sharanam braja aham tvam sarva papivyo mokshayishami masacha. Abandon all varieties of religion and surrender to me. Love me. Awaken your love for me. When we awaken our love for God that is dormant within us, we realize the oceanic love of God for us. And the oceanic love within the heart of that is what we're all looking for. That is the essence of religion. We were discussing previously, Pandita Samadarshana. When one loves God, one becomes universally compassionate to every living being. But there's also another lesson we could learn from the ass or donkey. The donkey is very, very eager to be the beast of burden, to carry massive loads on itself. You see, a honeybee, when it goes to a nice tree, it just takes the pollen nectar from the flower. It doesn't pick up the whole tree. It doesn't pick up the whole forest. It just goes right to the nectar. Yes? So in the name of religion, there are people who are so much attached to dogma. It's a vain, empty ritual. Sometimes they become very, very much attached to massive philosophical speculation. They become very exceedingly proud of all the knowledge they have and all the verses and slokas they can recite. And through all this knowledge of the scriptures, instead of becoming humble and gentle, they're becoming proud and envious. Similarly, people become egoistic. Whatever religion it may be, if we're not looking for the essence, the very religion that's supposed to make you humble, gentle, lover of God and all living beings can make you hateful, vengeful, and violent. A person who loves God cannot hate anyone. It's beyond their power. But people hate someone who is not like me. And we see this plaguing the planet. Sectarianism. In the name of religion. That is the mentality of the foolish ass. Who just takes all the externals, the burden of the externals, and carries it on their back. But the honeybee only seeks the essence of loving devotional service to the Lord. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, there's 18,000 verses. And its culmination, its conclusion, and this is the ripened fruit, the essence of all the Vedas. The last verse. Nama Sankirtanam Yasya Sarva Papa Panashanam. That in this age of Kali that we're living, what is the essence of life? To live purely. To learn to be humble and to bow down. And to chant the names of God. Kalera dosanide rajan astiheka mahanguna kirtanat eva krishnasya mukta sangha paramraja. The Bhagavatam declares that this age of Kali, this age that we're living in, is an ocean of faults. There's such criminal activities, such inhumane cruelty. Recently, Christina was telling me some horrible, cruel activities taking place in Africa. Unbelievable. Stalin, according to historians of Russia, they can only calculate about 25 million people he exterminated. Innocent, his own countrymen. Hitler killed over 8 million Jews. Innocent people. Apparently. Why? Such cruelty. And people are governments sometimes, rather than protecting citizens, they're oppressing citizens, depressing citizens. It's the age of Kali. Natural disasters. So many problems. So the Bhagavatam describes that this Kali Yuga is an ocean of faults. But there's one supreme benediction. There's also a lot of nice things, no doubt. But they come and go. But there's one benediction. Param Vijayate Sri Krishna Sankirtanam. That simply chanting Krishna's name sincerely, we can attain the perfection of liberation. Therefore, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who was Krishna himself, who came to this world in the age of Kali, came to teach us that there's so many spiritual arguments and so many sectarian concerns, and even within one religion, there's so much
disagreement and sometimes even violent competition. Yes? How many denominations of Hindus are there? How many denominations of Muslims? How many denominations of Christians? And sometimes they're killing each other. Just over some, slight ritualistic, philosophical difference. Yes? Therefore, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came with a universal spiritual path of divine love. He extracted the essence of the Vedas from the Kali Santarana Upanishad. In this age of Kali, one can attain the ultimate supreme perfection by practicing this Yuga Dharma of purifying the heart, awakening our original natural love by chanting the holy names. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama. Can you do louder, please?
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare.
Much, much louder, please. Thank you for your patience. Is there any questions you may like to ask?
I want to feel that this is happening in this world. Now, every day you will come to know that this is killed, there it has happened. I mean, what is the reason behind all this? I mean, the son is murdering father and daughter. I mean, what is this? The cruelty happening every now and then. Every time you listen to the news and all that, so you'll come to know ki, this thing happened, that thing happened. What is the real reason behind it? Why is it happening? I mean, roach ka aisa ho gaya hai.
Every day. Every minute. The statistics are staggering. How many murders, how many suicides. The problem can be approached from various levels. The police department, it is their duty to somehow or other capture these criminals. Yes? And then the Justice Department to convict the criminals. And then the Penal Department to imprison the criminals. Yes? But from a spiritual point of view, we understand that when people have unclean hearts, they are driven by passion and greed and envy and anger and lust to engage in such horrible activities. Essentially, everyone is a pure soul. But people incriminate themselves
with so much sinful activities. And the nature of a sinful activities is the more you engage in such activities, the more the inclination to do it again and again and again grows in your heart. And it becomes more and more and more perverted. We have very, very serious egoistic desires. And when a person's just burning with the fire of severe desires, when it's unfulfilled, it's a fire of anger. Yes? So the only real solution to the problem is people have to cleanse their hearts of lust, envy, anger, pride, greed, and illusion. That is the reason people do these things. Because their minds, their senses, their egos are just burning with these anartas or these contaminating substances. And it drives them to engage in wicked activities or unwholesome activities. People are so dissatisfied that they're taking intoxications. And intoxications is like fuel that creates horrible anger or depression or delusion or addiction. Yes? Alcoholism, drug addiction, violent crimes. And in the top 10 list of horrible diseases is depression. Within 30 years, the World Health Organization say it will be the number one problem that causes suffering and death in the world. Depression. Why? Because people have all of this desire and passion and greed and ego in their hearts, and it's just not being fulfilled. So that's the reason why. And there's only one solution: to clean our hearts and to help others clean their hearts. And how do we clean our heart? There's two ways that are very important. One is to stop putting dirt in it. That means somehow or other performing the austerity of living a moral life. And at the same time, cleaning it. By engaging our mind and senses in positive, purifying spiritual activities, hearing spiritual subject matter, associating with uplifting people, and chanting God's names. Are there any other questions?
Will you like to say, are the people who have died in the tsunami victims?
What would I like to say about?
Tsunami, which has come in this Asian nations, like Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia. I mean, why does it happen? So many people have killed in this.
It is explained in the scriptures, and also it has been explained by ecologists and philosophers throughout the ages, that when there is massive abuse of the resources of the earth and massive violent and sinful activities, then there will also be massive natural reactions. Human society is individually and collectively responsible for our actions. Hundreds of millions of innocent animals are being slaughtered every year. Millions of babies are being killed in the wombs of their mothers. Whether you believe in it or not, there's a karmic reaction. It's death. It's cruelty. so much illicit activity, so much greed, so much plundering resources of earth. Yes? There's karmic reactions, individually and collectively. So when the world is filled with these types of actions, it's expected that there's going to be massive natural disasters. Now, the particular people that are affected, we should understand that in this world, everyone is responsible for everyone else in one sense. What we do will affect so many people. Yes? If in America, one very, very big, high-posted man in a corporation was cheating, and tens and thousands of his innocent employees, they had to massively suffer because of him. Yes? If a father becomes an alcoholic, then the whole family, all the brothers and the sisters and the mother and the cousins, everyone suffers. Yes? Now, from the point of view of karma, it's very inconceivable why people are put in a particular situation where a particular situation of suffering comes. But we understand that there is individual karma as well as collective karma. So the same principle. We should simply feel compassion and pray for those persons. And those persons who remember God at that moment attain the ultimate perfection. Yes? And others will have to take their birth according to their particular state of consciousness. If they were pious, they're going to be elevated in their next birth. That we can understand as fact. No one's cheated. Ultimately, whatever happens, we're going to be punished or rewarded according to our consciousness. But still, it is the nature of any saintly person, paradukaduki, to feel for the sufferings of others and to try to do everything within our power to help. And what is the greatest help? To give people awareness of their eternal souls and to help people to clean their hearts and make this world a better place and to make our life a better place and ultimately to reach the highest destination. Does that answer your question?
I mean, many newborns are there in the tsunami victim which has been killed. So, I mean, you said it's because of collective karma. But according to me, no one can die without understanding the real meaning of spirituality. I mean, anybody who have come to life has to understand the meaning of God and all this, and then it has to be died. This is according to me. I mean, it's my experiences with saints.
But what is according to you is not always what happens. We have to understand that the soul in the child has gone through millions of lives. And whatever its knowledge, whatever its awareness, whatever its piety, whatever its impiety, is there to its credit. Yes? So if a child was good in past lives, that child is, even in an apparently disastrous situation, that child is going to be elevated, promoted to a more prosperous environment. Yes? The Bhagavad Gita explains that the soul is not killed with the body. Neither water or fire or anything can kill the soul. there any other questions?
I beg your pardon, Prabhuji. I have to ask one question. India, our motherland, is said to be the land of Lord Krishna and so many incarnations. And there is no want of big philosophy, big gurus, you know. They have their profound knowledge about spirituality. But still, what we watch in our everyday life is very menacingly increasing. People are being hypocrite and they are committing sin, and there is no decrease in it. Every day it is going up like anything. So India is said to be a holy land, and there is lot of philosophies and profound philosophies, and there are lot of spiritual gurus. But still, the trend of people, the sinful people, is increasing in number and number and number. Crimes are increasing. It's not decreasing. So, I feel personally very confused. Why is it happening?
Everything you say is very true. India is land of dharma. The deepest scriptures, the greatest history of saints, self-realized souls. However, the common people of India have forsaken their own culture. Their own spirituality is usually just very ritualistic and superstitious, without a real scientific, philosophical, or real basis. In most temples of India, people in a very superstitious way worship some god, but they don't even know really who it is or what it is. Yes? I remember in 1970, when I came to India, in those days, it was not such a westernized environment. So in New Delhi, there was a clothes store, and they got these mannequins, statues, that you put clothes on to sell them. And I guess people in India hadn't seen them before. So they had this good lady like this, and they had this man like this in a suit, and the lady was wearing some nice sari. And I saw dozens and dozens of people at the window bowing down and offering prayers. And some were giving, some paisas. I thought it was a deity. So that is a problem. Real spiritual education is quite rare. But a bigger problem than that is due to being under oppressive invaders for many centuries. The Mughals, the British. The British Empire very much conditioned the Indians, almost brainwashed the Indians, that anything from the West is first class and anything from India is third class. Our Guru Maharaj explains, when he was earlier, he was running a pharmacy in Allahabad called Prayag Pharmacy. And the father of one of the highest statesmen of this nation, he used to come to buy his medicines. And there was a medicine made in India. And there was another medicine made in the United Kingdom of London, England. And it was the exact same chemicals. In fact, it was made in India, one of them, and another one was made in India, shipped to London, packaged in London, and then sold in India for 5 times more money. And the person wanted to buy the medicine made in England. And Prabhupada said, but this is the exact same medicine. It's only 1/5 the price. And he said, no, if it's made in India, it's fifth class. England would buy tea leaves from India, ship it to London, put it in boxes, and sell it to India for large sums of money. The same tea in Indian boxes people didn't want. How is that? When Prabhupada went to London to give Krishna consciousness, he wanted to see, because his whole childhood, he was brought up in the British Empire. His whole childhood was just the glories of London. He was expecting that London would be something like Vaikuntha. But he saw it was a dirty city. And then he went to see, they brought him to the river Thames. And Prabhupada said, "I have come to see the glory of the mighty river Thames, and I see a dirty little trickle." So the conditioning is anything from the West is good and anything from India is less. Yes? It has been very, very deeply inculcated in Indian people. Western dress, Western music, Western television, Western, if it's from the West, it's very good. People are mad chasing after the West. So Prabhupada, he saw that people of India are so infatuated by the West. He went to the West and made Westerners devotees and brought them back to India. And then people of India were thinking, well, if you're an American and you say Krishna consciousness is good, then it must be very good. They wouldn't listen to Prabhupada. He was Indian. But when he brought Western disciples, they listened. That is a problem. Bharata bhumite hoila manusya janmajar janma saradaka kare kara paro upakar. That anyone, according to scripture, according to the Lord, anyone born in India, Bharat Bhumi, the land of Dharma, it is their responsibility. It is their first and foremost responsibility to realize God and live for the benefit of humanity by giving God consciousness. That is the duty, that is the responsibility of every Indian. But how many are taking it up? People are immersed in Western culture and people are immersed in politics. And people are immersed in so much economic concerns. Yes? And therefore they're not... There's nothing wrong with the West. Prabhupada said you could take all the technology and wonderful things of the West, and if you use it in God consciousness, that's yukta vairagya. That's wonderful. The other day I went to Prana Studios. And they're incredible technology. I've never seen such technology. Of course, I'm kind of from a prehistoric age as far as technology goes. Not kept up well. But what they're doing is state-of-the-art, 3D animation, unbelievable what they can do with computers. They could just create, they could create apparent realities and enthrall people's attention. And they're actually thinking of using that technology to display Krishna's pastimes. That's taking Western technology and utilizing it to enlighten people's consciousness rather than just exploit people. Yes? So there's nothing wrong with the technology. There's nothing with the economy. But the glory of India is to preserve, maintain, and nourish our own deep spiritual traditions, Sanatan Dharma. And then we can take all these wonderful things of the world and use it for that purpose. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
Prabhuji, one more thing. I'm a man from actually Bengal, Kolkata. The thing is this, actually in my college life, when I had been to my classes, so I actually remember one thing, one verse is from Chaitanya Charitamrita. Somebody says, Apani Achari Dharma Apari Shikhao. Means you have to behave yourself to preach something else. So what you are going to preach, please behave like that and then preach. But what you see, I'm not talking about ISKCON people or ISKCON devotees. I'm talking about, those Vaishnavas in general. In Bengal, you'll find so many, communities preaching almost more or less the same thing. Okay, they are highlighting Sri Krishna, Chaitanya Dev and all that. But the thing is this, most of them, when they go for the bhajanas or kirtans or whatever, shankirtans, whatever, and they assemble, they go for some discourse, spiritual discourse, and they speak very well. Okay, but when they come back home, I find to my surprise, they are the very same man like us. Like us. We common, idiot according to spirituality. Okay. Because we are unaware. So according to that, whatever my perception is like, but I don't find any change. I cannot discriminate between me and that guy who is giving that kind of lecture. So, there is a sense of what I mean is a hypocrisy. How to get rid of it? See, I am searching, sincerely searching for something into somebody. I am not a great being, but I am sincerely trying to find somebody who can show me the right path. But to my astonishment, at the end of the tunnel, I find, oh, you are still disappointing me. You are the very same man like me. So what you are speaking, what you are preaching, you are not according to that. You are doing something else. And I have found, there was a man actually in Kolkata. It's a nearby place called Kolkata, that is called Shodhpur. They were preaching some dharma called Ram Narayan Ram, Balak Brahmachari, by that name. Okay, and they were preaching something else, and after all, it was proved that he was a hypocrite and all that. And now that community is almost on the extinct. Okay, I don't know. But still there are some people, those who believe, still he was an incarnation or something like that. So what is happening? So when you are talking about Krishna consciousness or anything related to Chaitanya Mahaprabhuji, so people say, these are all hypocrite people. They say something and they do something else. So this kind of thing. But what I personally believe from our greatest scriptures like Bhagavad Gita and all that, so there is a great learning, never-ending lessons for us, but we people don't follow. That is our fault. But still, we need some, father figure or some spiritual guru who can really guide us from the front. But when you talk about it at home, even to my children, my wife, they say, these all are big people, these are all hypocrites, you don't believe in them. But when I say, if you believe them to be hypocrites, why don't you follow? Why don't you follow the principles all by yourself and try to be good and set an example? Okay. Then my wife says, no, we are very little creatures. We cannot do. But we need somebody who can really set an example all by themselves. Okay, that kind of thing. So how can we get rid of this hypocrisy and all that?
Thank you. Very good lecture. Kali Yuga is the age of quarrel and hypocrisy. It is a problem which has tormented all the great spiritual paths on earth. In Christianity, it was all Catholic Church. But when there was hypocrisy and corruption amongst the popes and leaders, priests, then Protestant, which means Protestant. Yes? Revolution. And starting other branches. And other branches and other branches. So we find this everywhere. It is a big problem. But wherever there's a counterfeit, we should understand there also must be the real thing. Counterfeit means an imitation of the real thing. So as they say, you should not throw out the baby with the bathwater. If the bathwater is dirty, you should throw out the bathwater, but protect the baby. So this is something that has very much devastated people's faith and hope, is when they see hypocrisy. So it is everyone's responsibility, according to this verse in Chaitanya Charitamrita that you began quoting, it is everyone's responsibility to not only speak correctly, but to live by what we speak. Knowledge gives the way, but only when we act upon that knowledge do we make progress. So hypocrisy is a very serious problem within the world we live. But if we're sincere, we're going to look for the essence. Even if there's so much sewage, even if there's so much garbage, like the honeybee, rather than just, you know, criticizing all the garbage, like the fly, like the honeybee, we should be looking for the essence. Looking for those people who are real. Looking for those people who are genuine. Looking for those people who are sincere. Yes? And in that association, for those who are honestly, earnestly striving to be real and genuine, even if they may have their weaknesses and they're honest about it, they're humble about it, and they're striving, they're struggling, they're trying. Yes? In that association with such persons, we will be elevated. Our faith, our hope, and our consciousness. And that is all important. When Prabhupada came to the West, that's what attracted us about him. Of course, I met him in India. But so many people, they were rejecting social norms because of hypocrisy. They were rejecting religions because of hypocrisy. Exactly. Almost everybody I grew up with cared nothing for their religions. Because they saw the people who were preaching, the people going to the synagogues and the churches and the masjids, they were just like everyone else. Materialistic, envious, greedy. What was the change of heart? What was the transformation? What was the honesty? What was the integrity? So we don't need it. And the same thing is happening in India. The same thing is happening worldwide. But when Prabhupada came, we saw, here is a person who has such deep knowledge and who lives by that principle. He's God intoxicated. He's without hypocrisy. And therefore, people who were atheistic, agnostic, and total sinners surrendered to him because they had faith. So we must look for people who are actually speaking and living the truth. And if we seek, by God's help, we will find. Is that all right? So it is late, and I'm sorry to keep you so long. There'll be kirtan, and then there's nice prasad. I sincerely thank all of you from my heart. We'll be celebrating. Tomorrow is Sunday festival. You are all invited. And from Thursday through next Sunday will be our Gaur Purnima festival, every morning and evening, celebrating the auspicious advent of Lord Chaitanya. There'll be classes and kirtans. And on April 2nd, there will be installation of beautiful deities of Lalita Vishaka on our altar. You are invited. And then April 3rd, Sunday festival. And that day, by God's grace, I will be traveling to the West for 5 months and be back in end of August. I'm very, very happy to have this opportunity to serve all of you in whatever way I can. Thank you very much.